Welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Preston.
And I'm Jason.
And Jason, today we steered away from the normal corn and soybean talk a little bit, which is kind of nice. We both mentioned a minute ago, we kind of like talking about some specialty crops. And in this case, specifically, we talked a lot about strawberries.
Yeah, it was really fascinating, at least for me. I think that even in this podcast, there's a lot of interesting, actionable advice for the home gardener that might pick it up. So listen in for that. We talked to Dr. Marvin Pritz, who's a professor and director of undergraduate studies in the School of Integrative Plant Science Horticulture Section at Cornell University in New York.
Yeah, and we talked to Marvin a lot about the production of strawberries, where strawberries are grown, some selection criteria that go into breeding the best strawberry. And we spent a lot of time talking about the most important part, which is flavor, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the growers will be interested to learn some of the things we found out about how the production practices affect flavor and where strawberries are grown and the impact that has. And so I'm not going to give it away, but you're going to have to listen in to find out.
So without further ado, let's jump right into the conversation with Dr. Marvin Pritz. Well, welcome to the podcast, Marvin. To kick things off here today, could you tell us a little bit about your background and what you're up to now?
Sure. I went to college as a biology major, wasn't really interested in being a doctor and all those pre-med courses, and took some plant courses and liked that a lot. Went to grad school, met a professor there who got a job at Michigan State as a blueberry strawberry breeder, and I followed him there. Got my PhD in horticulture, and came to Cornell almost 40 years ago now. Been working with berry crops ever since. My job involves working with strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, and any other thing that ends with the name berry. Is the crops I work with.
And all the stuff that tastes good.
All the stuff that tastes good, yeah. I have lots of friends in June and July. Not so many. At the university, I teach lots of classes. I do research. And I do extension work with the growers in the Northeast and around the country.
So this is on a personal note. Did you work some with Bob Skirvin at U of I?
I did. I knew Bob. Okay. Yeah, we overlapped quite a bit, and we go to meetings together and things like that. Yes.
Yeah, he was kind of legendary, at least for teaching at U of I, because he had a very good teaching style.
That's funny, because that was one of my favorite classes too. Yeah. 101. I love that class. Yeah.
Even the non-ag majors would take that class.
Like, yeah. My berry crops class is kind of the same way. I get students from all over the university to take it because they enjoy learning about berries. And we take lots of field trips and they get out to farms and see what's going on.
That's fascinating.
It's probably hard to ever get bored of berries. I mean, I'm a berry fanatic. I could eat my body weight probably, and strawberries, raspberries are my favorite. But I imagine it's something that it's really hard to get tired of berries, whether that's research or teaching or anything like that.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting about it is that everybody has a story about berries they can relate to. So when you tell people what you do, people light up and they tell me about picking blueberries with their grandfather, or the backyard strawberry patch, or even if they just like them, everybody can relate to that. And when I was doing other sorts of research before, you know, you started talking about your research and people would roll their eyes. But once you mentioned berries, you got their attention.
It seems you're probably working with developing new varieties and things like that, new cultivars. Have you done other research in regards to berries over the years? What has your research been involved with? 40 years is a long time.
Yeah. So at Cornell, we have a berry breeding program at our experiment station in Geneva. And so we have somebody whose job it is to develop new varieties of berries, and that's what he does. And so everything else involving cultural practices sort of falls in my lap. So a lot of the work we've been doing in the last several years is trying to figure out how to make strawberries available to the consumer for more than just 3 weeks of the year. And the same way with the raspberries, the seasons are so short, it makes it tough for growers to manage their cash flow, makes it tough to break into a supermarket. If you go to a supermarket and say, hey, I have the best berries, they really taste great, they're locally grown, what do you think? And a supermarket produce buyer tries and says, oh, these are really great, can you supply us with these berries all summer long? And the farmer goes, well, no, how about, you know, 3 weeks in June? Supermarket buyer, they're good, but, you know, I don't think I want to stop getting my berries from California and get yours for 3 weeks and go back. So bottom line is we've been working a lot with season extension techniques using strawberries that have lost the ability to respond to photo period. So they'll flower under all day lengths. And then by using low tunnels or high tunnels in the case of taller crops like raspberries and blackberries, we can extend the season from early June all the way into November. And wow. We've been looking at various techniques of managing the tunnels and the covers, looking at different types of coverings for these plants, looking at growing them under certain covers in the summer, then shifting to other covers in the fall. And that's sort of been an area that's I've been excited about, and we've had students do a lot of work with. For example, there are covers that reflect the light, and they also reflect the heat. So if you're growing strawberries in the heat of summer and you have a cover over them that reflects some of the heat and keeps it a little bit cooler, the plants will do better. And then as the day length shortens in the fall, there are now plastics that have these additives that shift the wavelength of light into the blue and red spectra, which are the wavelengths that the plants use. So you don't get a lot of green. It shifts, so it actually increases the photosynthetic reactive radiation under these covers. And so we shift those out into the fall when day lengths get shorter, the plants actually get more light than they would if they were exposed to just the full sun. And plus you get the protection from the plastic as well. When it gets cold, we can lower the sides of the tunnel. It's going to rain. We can lower the sides, and then we raise the sides of the tunnel when it's decent weather and let the air circulate. And yet the light coming in still is going through that plastic and, you know, changing the spectra. So there's all sorts of exciting things like that that we're doing. We're looking at different ways of propagating strawberries so we can get them started earlier, so we don't have to just plant them in the field in May and then have to wait, you know, 8 weeks before they start flowering and fruiting. We can start them in the greenhouse and plant them out into the field in May, and they're already 8 weeks ahead. And that helps with the heat because they get started so much earlier. We're looking at the bees that visit the strawberries at that time of the year, because normally strawberries flower for us, and you too, you know, in May, and they fruit in June. But nobody really knows what's visiting those strawberries if they're flowering in July and August and September. So we've done work looking at bee visits at that time of the year. And interestingly enough, honeybees do not like strawberries.
Really?
Things around. They'll go to other places. We rarely see a honeybee in our strawberries in the summertime.
What kind of bees?
They're wild bees. They're generally smaller, wilder bees that visit, but not the honeybees.
Well, that must explain something. I have my strawberries right by my beehives, and I don't seem to be a great strawberry grower, so the bees must not be helping.
Yeah, they probably find other things they like better.
Preston and I talk a lot about different technologies in agriculture, and you mentioned one that I'd never really given any thought to before, but you talk about the plastic that helps protect the plants, but then also modifies the wavelength of the light so that it's actually a higher photosynthetic rate, which is really interesting. Not something I had ever thought about before.
Yeah, we are working with a company in France that's manufacturing this material, and they're gearing up to, you know, market it worldwide. I think they probably have a patent on the technology, but we got in contact with them. They sent us material, and we tried it, and it works. You know, it doesn't make a huge difference, but it makes a small difference consistently, and it seems like it's something that, again, a new technology that we can think about in agriculture. You could make a high tunnel with it and grow taller crops under it just as well. For example, we've looked at raspberries, looking at their production in the fall. And again, the challenge we run into is the light levels just start dropping pretty dramatically after September 15th. And these plants, the fall fruiting raspberries, the primocane fruiting raspberries, still have a lot of flower potential in there that they just need to push out. And you can keep them warm with the tunnels, but the light levels generally you can't do anything about. And this is a way to sort of kick that light level up a little bit, maybe get you another week or two of production at the very end of October, maybe even into November, before it just gets too cold to ripen the fruit.
So that's really interesting. How long are these practices already being implemented, or will we have strawberries in November in central Illinois here in the next couple of years?
I think you can have strawberries in central Illinois in the next couple of years. You can do it this November if the grower, you know, put that technology out there. Not even necessarily the wavelength shifting technology, just a sheet of, say, 6 mil plastic polyethylene cover. You could do even a low tunnel where you can cover like a single row at a time. That works pretty well because you can pull the sides down and keep them down during that colder time of the year. And as long as those strawberries flowers have been pollinated, and there are even varieties that, you know, don't need pollination. We found there's one called Albion, seems to set fruit on its own. We don't even have to have bees. So you can put it out there, plant it in the spring. It starts flowering and fruiting in July, August, September, October. Put these covers down, keep them warm. They'll just keep going until it really freezes up. I have photographs of strawberries that I picked with snow on the ground between the rows.
Oh, wow.
That sounds like it's feasible for even a home gardener almost, that wanted to go a little extra work here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So when you think about like domestic and even global strawberry production, is that distributed pretty evenly geographically, or is there a sweet spot where the majority of this production occurs? Is there a certain soil type, or is it consistently spread across the U.S., for instance?
So it's probably 90% of the strawberries that you see in the supermarket are grown in California. So okay. 90%.
Wow, that's a lot.
Probably, yeah, another 6 or 7% are grown in Florida. And then everybody else shares that smaller 5%. But here's the difference. I'm talking about strawberries sold in the supermarket. If you look at strawberry production that's sold directly to the consumer, that is evenly spread across the country because most of that's directly sold through farmers markets or pick your own. Hmm. So you have to have the production close to where the consumers are. So if you look at a state like you're in and like I'm in, we're not putting a lot of strawberries on the wholesale market. We're not breaking into the supermarkets, but there are farm stands and pick your own operations all over the place, particularly around the cities. So it's sort of like a bifurcated distribution. There's gotcha. A lot of concentration of commercial crop, but then there's this huge spread of everything else. Probably just about every city in the country has a strawberry farm close to them. And strawberries are really adaptable. Like you can manipulate them so they can produce fruit just about anywhere. I think it's been said that strawberries are the most widely grown fruit crop in the world because, and even in California, what they do is amazing. They grow the strawberries in the Central Valley where it's really hot, but they're only growing them for runners, for propagation material, because it's too warm to produce fruit buds. Then they dig them from there. They move them to the mountains up in Northern California.
Oh, wow.
Where it's cooler. And when the day lanes start getting short in the middle of October, they dig them up again and they take them down to the coastline and plant them in Watsonville and, Irvine and places like that along the coast where it stays cool, but not too cold. And the day lengths are short and they just keep stimulating flower production. And that's allowed strawberries in California to be produced for 6 or 7 months of the year, and even longer. And it's a really extended season, but it's all because of these strawberries that they've lost their sensitivity to day length. They're not what we call strong short day plants. They're weak or they're neutral to the length of the day. And that's opened up lots of possibilities. And, you know, those plants, they grow just fine in Illinois or New York or wherever. The problem is we have winter. It just is too cold for them to keep going. So
strawberries are a perennial crop. Perennial plant, but they're growing them basically each season. They're replanting them, say, up in the mountains. Then they're physically taking the plants and moving them to the coast. And then they're starting over the next year with new plants, new runners from those plants.
Exactly.
Okay.
perennial plants, but they're grown as annuals. They're grown as annuals in California and Florida. In Florida, they grow the strawberries in Canada, and they dig them in October and ship them to Florida and plant them in Florida and grow them just for the winter, and then they dig them out again. Wow, and then they fumigate. They fumigate between crops so they can go back into the same soil again with strawberries. They've not bred resistance to soil diseases in those strawberry varieties, so they have to fumigate or rotate. And in California, where land, in Florida too, land is so expensive, it's not really economical to rotate. It's cheaper to fumigate and go back into the same soil. In the north, we've tended to grow our strawberries as perennials, and they have been selected for resistance to soil diseases. But with these day neutral types, you can grow them as perennials, but they do best as annuals. Grow them for 1 year, take them out, plant again, grow for another year. You can overwinter them, but the second crop isn't as nice as the first year crop. But regular June strawberries, and it's still the majority of strawberries, they're fruit in June. Those are short day plants grown as perennials. Growers will plant them in the spring. They don't produce any flowers that first year because the day lengths are long and temperatures are warm. They initiate flower buds when the days get short in the fall, the overwinter, and then that following spring, they flower profusely, fruit a lot in June, early July, but then the days are long and it's hot again, so they don't make any more flowers. They just make runners. So we have those two types of strawberries, the June bearing and the day neutral type.
So what do you recommend for a home gardener in Illinois or New York?
So we recommend the short day types, that fruit just in June, because the day neutral types require a little bit more intensive management, and most homeowners aren't really set up to do that. You have to really pay attention to watering because they're fruiting during the summer. And the other thing that's a real challenge is fertilization. These day neutral plants have really shallow roots, and you have to feed them almost constantly with nitrogen. Mm. So a commercial grower is set up to do that with drip irrigation. They can inject nitrogen every week, and the plants do great. But if you're a homeowner, it's a little bit harder to do that. And then also in the summertime, the insect pests increase. And so we get things like tarnished plant bug, which aren't as bad in the springtime when the flowers are out. But if you put a flower out in July, particularly if somebody nearby has cut some alfalfa, or those tarnished plant bugs will just flock to the strawberries, and then they cause deformity of the fruit. And homeowners don't mow the lawn. They don't really recognize what these tarnished plant bugs are, and they see these little nubby, deformed fruit, and they think, oh, I didn't water enough. But really, it's the tarnished plant bug feeding on flower, causing the deformity. And that's just, you know, one example of an insect pest that increases as summer goes on. You know, mites increase. And so the day neutrals are just more finicky and a little bit harder to manage. But there's no reason you can't. It's just more of a challenge to do it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned several different criteria along what you select for, things like day length, disease resistance. I was curious where flavor fits into that selection criteria.
That's a really good question. So there are a lot of varieties that have been released over the years, and some taste good and some don't taste so good. We did a study several years ago where we got strawberries that were released from the 1890s, because they're vegetatively propagated and they have a germplasm repository, so you can keep these plants for years and years and years. So we got plants from 1890, from 1900s, from 1910 that were released then, and we planted them in a common, you know, field. And then we evaluated them for a lot of different traits to see what happened over the last 100 and some years of breeding. And we found that things you would expect, like size, definitely went up, you know, over time. A firmness went up over time, but sugar content kind of went down over time slightly. And sugar is often an indicator of flavor, because when we eat a strawberry and we taste the sugar, that tastes good to us. And strawberries vary a lot in that. So sometimes growers do a good job and the variety has all these traits of disease resistance and maybe day neutrality and tastes good, but sometimes, you know, the flavor is just a little bit short. We did some studies on what causes strawberries to taste good or what causes the sugar content to be high and the acid content to be high, because you want both high sugar and acid for the strawberry to have some bite to it and yet be sweet. And what we found was that it was the temperatures, the temperature differential while those strawberries were developing that was most strongly related to sugar content.
Really?
In other words, warm days and cool nights gave you the best flavor.
Really?
That differential shrunk the sugar content of the strawberry at harvest also was diminished. So on a day neutral strawberry that fruits from say June through October, you're going to see changes in flavor. It's not going to stay constant. The flavor is going to diminish somewhat in the summertime when the nights warm up, and it's going to increase towards fall when the nights start getting cooler.
So does that mean strawberries from California, all things being equal, a fresh strawberry off the plant, you know, maybe tastes better from California than say Illinois, where in California the day night temperature delta is much greater than somewhere like Illinois where there's a lot more humidity, or not necessarily?
That could be the case, all things being equal, including the variety. But the varieties that grow in California typically aren't the varieties that are grown in Illinois. So you have a variety difference there. And the other thing, you have a difference in when the fruit is harvested. So, you know, the strawberries are harvested 3 or 4 days before they get to the supermarket. If they're harvested in California and shipped to Chicago on a truck, whereas you're picking it fresh off the plant. So the Illinois strawberry has a couple of advantages right there. You know, it's picked fresh, ripe, and the varieties have generally been selected more for flavor. In California, the selection is more for yield and size because, you know, in supermarkets, we don't let people sample fruit before they buy it. You just have to look at it and make a decision. So they breed based on appearance and not so much on flavor. That's why, you know, when you see these beautiful peaches in the supermarket, you get them home, they're hard as a rock, they don't taste good, but they look great. And the same thing with strawberries. And Americans are conditioned to buy with their eyes. You know, it's just something about Americans, bigger is better. So you see those great big strawberries in the supermarket, you think, oh, those really taste good, but not necessarily.
It almost seems like the big ones never taste as good as the small ones. And maybe that's just where they're grown, but is there any kind of relationship whatsoever between size and flavor?
Not in strawberry, at least not that we've been able to find, but there is in blueberry. And all the flavor in blueberry is in the skin. Like if you peeled a blueberry and just that little white in the middle and you blindfolded somebody and put that in their mouth, they wouldn't be able to tell you what it was. It's just
interesting.
A ball of sugar. There's no flavor whatsoever.
Yeah.
No flavor whatsoever. And people might say, oh, it's a grape that you peeled, like a this grape. They wouldn't be able to tell because the flavor is in the skin. So as the blueberries get bigger, the ratio of skin to volume decreases. In other words, if you picked a quart of big blueberries, there's less skin in that quart than there is a quart of small blueberries. So if you make a pie of the big blueberries or the small blueberry pie is going to have more skin and therefore more flavor than the bigger blueberry. Hmm. It's just, that's the law of physics. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, breeding or anything. It's just the bigger the blueberry, the less skin there is per volume.
Really useful piece of information I'm going to share with my wife.
There you go. Yeah. But on strawberry, really haven't found a really strong correlation. Probably the best flavored strawberry that I've ever eaten in my life is one called Early Glow. And I believe it was released in like maybe the 1970s from the USDA. It's pretty old now, but in my opinion, no one's come close to mimicking the flavor, imitating the flavor of Early Glow. And that's still available. You can still buy it from nurseries. It's still really good. So it's not so great for commercial growers because the first fruits are nice and big, but then it falls off and gets small pretty quickly. So commercial growers don't want to pick it because it takes too much labor. It's always better if you're paying labor. You know, everybody wants big fruit because you can fill up your containers faster. But if you're a homeowner and you want something that tastes super good, Early Glow is the variety to get.
Nice.
We're getting a lot of actionable information
here. Yeah. Yeah.
So I have one other question about the flavor. Do different production practices besides the day-night temperature differential, there's not much you can do about that. It's kind of a function of where you're at. Maybe you can control it a little bit in some in a little bit of a controlled environment setting, but how much effect do cultural practices have on strawberry flavor outside of that?
Yeah, so I had a graduate student who asked that very question. We grew strawberries under 9 different production systems, ranging from organic to conventional, conventional with lots of pesticides used, conventional with not many pesticides used. Same with organic. We looked at straight organic versus organic with like root dips and all these biological sprays and all that. We looked at low organic matter in the soil to high organic matter in the soil. Anyway, 9 different combinations over 2 years. We looked at all these factors on strawberry, and of course yield was different among these systems. Of course, the more fertilizer and more intensively you grow them, the more yield you're going to get. But we also looked at sugar, acid, and flavor volatiles. We worked with a wine specialist who has a gas chromatograph that can measure all these volatiles that are coming out of strawberry. We did not find any difference in sugar, acid, or flavor based on the way they were grown. We did find differences in their yield and size, but not on their flavor. So a lot of people claim that, oh, these taste better because, you know, they're organically grown or whatever. We didn't find evidence of that. And again, when people compare, say, organically grown to conventionally grown strawberries, they're different farms, different soil types, different varieties. It's really comparing apples and oranges, literally. But, you know, we tried to do it all on one farm. So it was the same soil type, the same variety. Everything was the same except the way we grew them. And we could not, we tried. We thought there would be, but we did not find anything that we could measure that showed a difference.
That's really interesting. So the best strawberry, probably from everything you've said here today, I feel like, is probably your best chance of getting the best strawberry is the one you pick right when it's ready. It doesn't get shipped 2,000 miles to get there. Maybe there really is something to the one that you pick from your own garden is better than the one from the grocery store.
Well, I think that's true. You know, a strawberry that's harvested when it's still not quite ripe, still has a white tip or white, it'll turn red. It'll turn red in shipping, but that it doesn't accumulate any more sugar because there's nowhere for that sugar to come from. An apple, since it stores starch, it will sweeten up over time because that starch will break down into sugar. So you can eat an apple in October and it might taste good and all, but you eat it again in January, it might, oh, this is really sweet because that starch converted to sugar. But on a strawberry, it doesn't store starch. So what sugar is in there, it's in there. You'll still get, you know, development of those anthocyanins and the strawberry will color, but it won't sweeten up. So that's another reason why strawberries are shipped a long distance. Might look really nice and nice and red, but they may not have a lot of sugar. And when we eat a strawberry, we're sensing 3 things. We're sensing sugar, acid, and aroma volatiles. The aroma volatiles are coming in our nose. The sugar and acid are on our tongue. A strawberry that's real sweet and very little acid will just taste, you know, there won't be any bite to it. And the other way around, it'll be sour. So you want to balance between those two, coupled with fragrance when you bite into it that goes up your nose and stimulates all those neurons up there. And there was something like, you know, 200 flavor volatiles in a strawberry. It's amazing. There's so many that are released when you eat them. And probably different people, and we know this, different people have odor blindness for certain smells. So what a strawberry that tastes really good to me might not taste really good to you because you're not sensing the same thing that I am, and you know, vice versa. That's why it's really hard for breeders to select for flavor.
Wow.
Because it's people's perception varies.
I want to go back a little bit. You had mentioned the different production practices and the conventional practices compared to organic. Recently, the Environmental Working Group released their Dirty Dozen so-called report. And I think maybe strawberries were at the top of the list again. I'd just be interested in your comments. It's been several years, right?
Yes.
What can you say to that?
We perennially hold the number one spot. There's lots I can say about that. One is, the methodology that's used. So what they do is they look at the USDA database. They don't collect their own data, look at the database. And if a strawberry has a residue on it from a particular chemical, gets a check. And then if it has a residue from a second chemical, it'll get a check and a third and so on. And I mean, because strawberries are often grown in like Florida where it's warm and, you know, there's no winter, you know, they do get pesticides applied to them, different pesticides. But the problem with the working group, it doesn't measure the amount. It just measures mm-hmm. presence, absence. I mean, we all know this ourselves that, you know, something in a really tiny amount doesn't have any toxic effect at all on us, but if there was a lot of it, it might. So these residue levels are measuring, don't measure amount. So you can't really extrapolate and say, oh, it's harmful. It's just, you're just looking at the number. The USDA data show that almost all these residues are way, way below tolerance. So they're not close to the level which would cause harm. The other thing I would say is that we actually want growers to use different chemicals when you're treating for pests, because if you use the same chemical time and time again, you're going to select for resistance. And yet the environmental working group would give that a really high score if you grew strawberries and you only used Malathion and Captan as your pests, and that's all you used, it would get a high score because it only had two check marks. And a grower that was rotating pesticides might have a score of 10, that would be bad. So it actually penalizes growers that are using good IPM practices. And then thirdly, if you look at the foods that are really good for you, that are just loaded with vitamins and nutrients and all, strawberries would probably be one of the top fruit crops, and spinach, which actually is number two on the Environmental Working Group list this year, is also a great crop. So you're discouraging people from eating things that are really super healthy for you by making them think these are just loaded with pesticide residues, when there may be some presence of those there, but they're at such small amounts, it's not going to cause any harmful effect. In fact, I don't think anyone's ever documented anybody getting sick from pesticide residues on food. Far greater concern is like bacteria on food from E. coli and from, you know, people not washing their hands when they pick the fruit. And it's the bacteria that causes death and illness among people, not pesticide residue. So I take it with a grain of salt. I don't think it's a very accurate description. I would say that we do want to encourage growers to use as few pesticides as possible in the most judicious way possible. And a lot of our research at universities is aimed at just that. But I think getting all concerned about the residue is misguided. We should be more concerned about maybe using pesticides in a way that damage bees, because you mentioned bees earlier, or mm-hmm. get into the groundwater or something like that, but not residue on food. There's just no evidence that that's a cause of concern. And yet, I think the Environmental Working Group plays that up to get people scared and fearful. And I think that's really misguided, because it discourages people from eating things that are good for you.
So the methodology, I'm just, and maybe I'm kind of misunderstanding this or maybe not, but it seems like, and I think you alluded to this, if you're just looking at the presence of how many potential chemicals there are, it's really not getting to the main point. I mean, what you'd really be concerned about is if there's an excessive residue of one or more, right? So there could be a product that would be just, I'm not saying there is out there, but with their methodology, there could be something out there that really was a risk because of one specific compound, but it's not going to show up highly because they're not even looking at that. They don't even know what that product, that food would be.
Possibly, yeah.
You mentioned the real danger probably in most produce is bacteria. Is there more risk, or is there any data that there's more risk of bacterial infection from organic, given that they would probably be more likely to use, say, animal manure for fertilizer rather than synthetic nitrogen, for instance? Is there any correlation there at all, or is that kind of a non-issue?
It's one of those issues that's a really hot button issue, and the answer is probably yes, probably a higher incidence in organic produce just because of the use of manure than there is in conventional produce. So the risk is probably higher, but it's a real controversial topic to get into because We don't want to discourage organic growing, and we don't want to disparage organic growers. But when you just evaluate the risks straight up, anytime you're using manure, it can be a good thing. Even conventional growers probably should be using more manure. Otherwise, it's a waste product and causes pollution. But you got to know how to use it appropriately. And we have rules about that, you know, 120 days from the time it's applied before you harvest fruit off of it. But oftentimes you'll see leafy green crops that are organically grown. So they're close to the ground and they got splashing on them, are oftentimes a source of foodborne illness. Not always, but I haven't seen data on this, but just my reading the news and so forth, I think I hear about it more frequently from organically grown produce where manure was used than conventional produce where it wasn't.
It's unfortunate because, like you say, the manure is there. The manure needs to be used. Growers just have to use it judiciously and follow, just like any pesticide, they need to follow the rules and regulations and guidelines, right?
Right. And, you know, one of the critiques of our farming system in the United States is that we have this very segregated farming system where you specialize in one or two things, corn and soybeans over here, the animal agriculture is over here, and you can't get them together. The same way with these small, especially crop growers, you know, they're oftentimes far removed from where the manure is generated. And we need to like close those cycles to be more sustainable. And that's just been a challenge for us in our country where we've gotten so big and specialized. It makes it hard to do that.
Cool. Well, Marvin, it sounds like you have a really fun job.
I do.
Especially if there's taste tests involved. I'm curious. So we always ask this question at the end of the interview. What excites you the most when you consider the future of agriculture and specifically berry production?
Yeah, what excites me the most, I mean, this really surprises me, but here at Cornell University, you know, sort of the elite Ivy League school, there are a lot of kids that are interested in their food, where the food comes from and producing food and growing food and just interested in that whole thing. And it's pleasing to me, but surprising as well with such interest. So it gives me hope that our young people are really engaged in understanding where the food comes from and want to be involved in it in some way. And I also think it's exciting that there are so many ways that you can get involved in agriculture as a young person without necessarily being the actual farmer, but there's so many jobs that are related to that where you can use technology and computers or, you know, biochemistry or whatever your entomology, whatever you're interested in, you can bring it to bear in our food system. And it's going to be more and more critical as time goes on that people know how to use those tools to grow food more sustainably. And so it excites me that there's that interest out there.
We talk about this all the time, you know, especially in technology. There's so many different paths now that can kind of lead back to agriculture and even berry production, you know. So that's cool to see. And especially it's exciting just the opportunities that are out there for students going into the future.
I think the challenge for students is, you know, buying in. You know, the capitalization costs are pretty high. A lot of students want to be farmers, they want to get involved, but, you know, it's just really hard to buy the land now and to do it. And so I think that would be a really good role for the government, is to be able to help these students, you know, transition into farming because they want to do it. It's just financially challenging.
Yeah, and there was maybe a time 50 years ago or something where there were plenty of bright people that wanted to be involved in agriculture, but really it was the people that had to be interested in an agriculture degree, say, for instance. And now with all these computer science / agriculture majors or things like that, I agree with you. It's a really exciting time. I think agriculture is set to take another giant leap forward here in the near future.
Yep.
For sure. Well, that being said, I think this is a good place to call it a wrap. We appreciate your time here, Marvin. Sure. The conversation has been great.
Thank you. Appreciate doing it.
The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the program hosts or their employer.